I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Christopher Emden wrote a recent piece asking why black men quit teaching. He writes, former Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan brought this theory of black teachers being important role models for particularly African-American young males in schools in the country. He gave speeches about it at historically black colleges and universities, and his successor, John King Jr., has taken up the argument. Only 2% of our nation's teachers are African-American. The argument, our guest writes, may be well-intentioned, but it's a cop-out. Why? We'll ask him that during the course of this conversation. Christopher Emden is an associate professor at Teachers College, Columbia University. He also serves as the associate director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education. He is the author of For White Folk Who Teach in the Hood and The Rest of Y'all Too, Reality Pedagogy and Urban Education. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Professor Emden. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page where there will be a posting of this article is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Professor Emden, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
It's an absolute pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, great to have you here. So why is it a cop-out what former Secretary of Education Arnie Duncan and John King said, that it's important to have black men as teachers and role models in the classroom?
So the issue is not whether or not we need these folks in classrooms, nor is it that we have a lot of issues in classrooms related to the performance of young men of color. The cop-out is identifying a problem and not offering solutions. And so, you know, my angle in all of this work is to sort of step away from this this existing system where folks will identify that there's fire in a room, be sitting right next to a fire extinguisher and not be concerned at all about putting it out. So it's always a cop-out if there are no solutions being offered, if there's no policy being put in place to be able to address these issues, and if the existing recruiting efforts are not working.
Mm-hmm. And the number of issues that a lot of these young people are dealing with, you remind us of these, are pretty extensive. Adverse effects of poverty, the inequitable distribution of resources across communities, criminalization of black men inside and outside of schools. There are a whole host of issues here.
They absolutely are. And, you know, this is not at all to say that those issues don't have merit. In fact, I like to make the argument that we don't focus enough on not just the issues, but why those issues are at play. So, for example, when we're talking about, you know, the lack of distribution of resources in schools, we have to have conversations about what are the funding sources, who's making decisions on what gets funded, or even when things get funded, are they things that meet the needs of those populations? So it's to sift beyond the existing narrative and the sound bites, and to say, let's dig a little bit deeper, so because when we dig deeper, we can get to the core of the issue, and then we can also start constructing some ways to be able to address these issues.
Let's go back to when you were in school, because you write about vividly remembering as a boy having a black male teacher who didn't see any value in you as a person. You had a bad experience.
I absolutely did, and that experience echoes those of many students that I've interviewed or many that I've worked with myself. And what happens is that, you know, there's an expectation that a black male teacher is going to automatically make me a good student. And while that teacher may serve as a mentor and may be supportive in many ways, if that teacher is not prepared to be able to teach me effectively, if that teacher is employing tools that a white teacher may employ who does not know the right thing to do, or if that teacher is following policies that don't meet my needs, their black face alone is not going to offer a solution. It might serve as sort of exemplars that I can look to when I engage with them. If they don't connect to me, then they may as well be somebody of another race or another ethnicity. So just recruiting black men alone will not solve our problem. And we're focusing on recruiting black men without focusing on what they need to be effective for black young people or for brown young people or for white young people. But teacher training, teacher effectiveness, effective curriculum, new strategies has to be coupled with ushering new folks into the field.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that African-American men are somehow taught, or they believe themselves, that their role in the classroom, not only to be a role model, but this idea of tough love, this idea of disciplinarian, does that fall on black male teachers?
Absolutely. So I've written and speak about this extensively. There's an age-old historical notion that young people of color need tough love. While I argue that they need love, the notion of tough love is problematic because once you sort of describe it as them needing you to be angry, you being tough, you not allowing them to be able to sort of like fully grow and develop as other young people, then you don't give them the care that they need. So tough love oftentimes erases care. Tough love erases second chances. Tough love erases sort of opportunities to be able to, need emotion. So this idea that young boys of color, for example, shouldn't be crying. This idea of calling a 4-year-old or a 5-year-old little man, when in reality that young person needs to be just a boy, is part of the tough love narrative, and that inhibits those young men from being able to sort of grow up and fully actualize. And it affects them academically.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back, if we could, to this figure, though, of only 2% of the nation's teachers are African-American males. What is it about the profession that's not very attractive to black adults, males?
Well, I don't believe that that the field is not attractive. I think it's that the field has been sold in a way where you don't want to do it. And I think that's different from attractiveness. Like, attractiveness is like whether or not I want to be able to teach. Young black men want to teach, but they also these notions of what a teacher looks like, that's not cool. So it's not the desire to teach per se. It's the perception of what it requires to teach. So to me, teaching is a discipline where I have to yell at kids a lot, or teaching is a discipline where, I have to deal with these bad kids and I have extra responsibilities because I'm a black male. If teaching is a field where I'm not going to be making enough money, all those things play a role, and I think all those things can be addressed.
You had a teacher who ran into your office, Joseph Matthews, his name. You cite him in your article. He said, "I can't look at these black boys in the face and make them feel like I felt in school anymore. I have to quit." What was he carrying on? What did he feel in school?
That story is so heartbreaking. And what happened was that he went into the school to teach, and then in 2 months he was told to be the dean of behavior. And then he was charged with going from classroom to classroom to ensure that these black young men were wearing the appropriate school uniform. Mm. And when they did not wear the uniform, he had to pull them out of the classroom, he had to call their parents, and he had to suspend them. So now he no longer became a teacher who just loved the art and craft of teaching or loved math or loved science. He became the person that had to police young people. He went from being a teacher to become a warden, to become, almost a criminal justice sort of enforcer. And that's not what he went into the field to do. And this happens to black men quite often when they go into schools, is that by virtue of their blackness and their mentalness, society stereotypes about who they are have to be played out on their students.
Mm-hmm. When you talk about the kind of training that is needed, when you talk about the kind of training that you do probably at Columbia University, what's a way to reach young people who might have some discipline issues the first couple days that you walk into class, who have a substantial number of problems at home? What are the ways, this is the $64 million question, to engage young people to really want to learn?
It's a complex question, but it's an easy answer. Anytime that you can convince a young person that they have the sort of natural ability to be academically successful by being who they are, you have them have a different relationship to schooling. So part of the major work we have to do is around self-confidence. It's about self-affirmation. It's about believing that you can be black and smart, that you can be cool to have swag and also be an intellect and an intellectual, that the fact that you love hip-hop music, for example, means that you already have the ability to be able to soak in a lot of information and spit it back out. The fact that you can memorize a rap album means that you can memorize the periodic table. Allowing them to feel that their natural selves are automatically intellectual and academic goes a long way.
Mm-hmm. And do teacher training programs reflect that, or give us an idea of how teachers are being trained in many universities that may not be exactly what you just outlined?
Well, absolutely. I mean, what I do with my students, we take on a lot of different approaches to preparing them that are not really used at all in the traditional teacher preparation program. So, for example, we take teachers who want to go into urban spaces into the communities where they're going to teach and help them to identify heroes and icons within that community. We identify barbershops. We identify the churches. We identify the bus drivers, folks who have cultural capital in the community. And we have the teachers form relationships with them so those relationships can then be extended into the classroom. Beyond that, we look at participation and engagement. So I have my teachers studying rap videos or rap performances to see how the rapper can command the audience of the crowd, because there's something there's a sort of cultural disposition that is needed, or cultural understanding that is needed to be able to engage a particular demographic. So we study rap videos, we study preachers. Ooh. You know, in my book, I write about the concept of Pentecostal pedagogy, because there are effective preachers in black churches who understand how to engage an audience who comes from a particular demographic. And I feel like teachers can be trained if they study those folks. So rather than read some empty textbook about teaching that somebody wrote 150 years ago that does not understand the complexities of urban America and youth of color, why don't you go and understand and study the folks in those communities who are teaching every single day, because they can teach you to be better.
Mm. So tell me, if you have a wonderful teacher training program for African-American male or a white male, and you're sending, unfortunately, most of our schools in many parts of the country have resegregated, so we're looking at a lot of almost all black schools, at least in the city of Milwaukee, does it make a difference, if everything else being equal, how engaged you are, how charming you are, how kind you are, how you understand all of these issues, the aforementioned issues, does it make a difference to have as a role model somebody who's an African American rather than a white teacher?
Listen, positive role models come in all races, all classes, and even all genders. Now, are folks naturally more likely to identify somebody who looks like them as a role model? Yes. However, you can go and connect with somebody who looks like you and discover really quickly that they don't love you. And then they become your enemy rather than your role model.
Hmm.
And so in our work, we really identify not just based on sort of like automatic racial connections, but rather how can you build a teacher cadre or teacher force that understands the cultural leanings of particular populations. If we focus on that first, other things work out. Now, with that being said, do I have a black male educator who is trained appropriately, who can connect the young people? Will that person with the proper skill set be extra successful with students who look like them? Absolutely yes, because they are now adding on top of the natural sort of phenotypic connection,
mm-hmm,
ways to be able to engage with them. But the approach is effective for everyone. And this is why, you know, I wrote my book. The book is entitled For White Folks Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too, because a majority of teachers are white in urban spaces, but just because you're white doesn't mean that you can't be effective. And the rest of y'all, too, means that there are 2% of these teachers who are African-American males, or the larger percentage of African-American women, also need to learn those strategies. Race and ethnicity alone does not bar you from needing to study your craft and to understand the nature of teaching and learning.
And what percentage of the country's teacher colleges fall in the category of Columbia? Most of them, 50%, 75%, or 2%?
Believe it or not, I believe a vast majority of teachers of schools of education have folks who are there who understand this work. And the issue is not whether or not they have faculty who can understand these issues. The issue is whether or not we have enough people who understand how to do it. So I think the big gap is not in understanding the philosophy I'm laying out here. The big gap is in understanding how to implement said philosophy. And so as far as implementation is concerned, I would say that about half, as far as understanding the ideas, many more do. And my work has always been focused on merging theory and practice, understanding this intellectually, but also being able to give teachers what they need. So, you know, when I write my book or I write the New York Times piece or I give a speech, it's not only about telling you what intellectually can go wrong or what intellectually can go right. It's like, okay, now let me coach you on how to do this work better.
Let's welcome phone calls for you. We'll take them in just a minute. Our guest this hour is Professor Christopher Emden, Associate Professor at Teachers College, Columbia University. He is Associate Director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education. He's author of For White Folk Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. And he is coming to our attention because of an article that he wrote that has the title, Why Black Men Quit Teaching. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you at this very moment, and we would love to hear from you. And we're on Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. Richard in Fort Atkinson is first for you. Hi, Richard.
Thank you. First, I want to say that I am a white guy, But I believe the following. First, black teachers must be able to teach subjects that they respect. Two, black students must be able to take subjects that they can respect. And this applies especially in social studies, American history, for example. The history books that are provided to American high schools are standardized history. And I think many black students, many black people who I know, feel that American history is misrepresented and they have no stake in that history. For example, what is misrepresented is the Native American genocide, according to policies of such founding fathers as Washington, Jefferson, and Jackson, all of whom participated in that genocide. The history of lynching and slavery in the United States is, how shall I say, not romanticized, but given short shrift. And then there are local examples such as Milwaukee. In the 1960s, there were big housing demonstrations led by the NAACP and Father Grappi for fair housing laws. Nothing, absolutely nothing, has occurred in Milwaukee since that time, and black folks are still imprisoned in the same Northside ghetto, which is really a concentration camp without barbed wire.
Do you think that history is taught, so those important parts of history that Richard just outlined are there for students to learn, Professor?
Well, you know, first I want to say that Richard is absolutely correct. And when I talk about strategies for helping teachers to be more effective, one of those strategies is ensuring that the curriculum reflects the histories and the realities of the young people. Mm-hmm. If you go and teach someone and they feel as if what you're teaching them is lies, they will not learn from you. And I want to extend this to say it's even beyond social studies, even in the sciences or mathematics. So in the sciences, we learn about Harriet Tubman, for example. She was a great hero. No one talks about the fact that Harriet Tubman was a brilliant scientist to be able to identify the North Star, that she had engineering skills to be able to lead the slaves north, or that she understood complex ecology to be able to do what she did. Young people don't know about Thomas Fuller, who was an amazing African-American mathematician who existed during slavery time. And in the book, I actually write about the connections between the indigenous and the neo-indigenous. And what I mean by that is the experiences of indigenous Native American folks in American schools and the experiences of urban youth in cities like Milwaukee and how they have the same similarities and the same processes. And so one of my strategies of getting young folks of color to be more engaged and to help teachers to be more effective is to actually look back and redefine and refocus on the curriculum to ensure that the curriculum reflects the realities and the histories of the students. So I wanted to thank Richard wholeheartedly for making those points and to say that he's absolutely correct. And that is part of how we train our teachers. And the teachers that I work with, is how you take existing curriculum and you extract it out of the school building and then you re-immerse it in the communities and their history. And that is an effective strategy for connecting young folks of color. And it's also a strategy for retaining teachers because teachers don't want to teach curriculum that does not reflect their real lives. And so, you know, this work is not just about students. I make the argument that if you have a teacher that is connected to the subject matter and is passionate about it,
right,
and reflects their real life, and they have students who do the exact same, you get a different response than we have thus far.
Thank you, Richard, very much for your call. Let's go next to another Richard? Oh, what are the chances of that, huh? Richard in Madison. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon, Kathleen. What a very interesting topic this afternoon. First of all, I'm an African-American male who relocated from Illinois to Madison. But I went to school in Illinois and was blessed to have for 2 years a phenomenal African-American teacher who's also a businessman who instilled pride and a sense of us in me growing up. But I was also blessed to have a white ex-Marine teacher who was a physical ed teacher who instilled a number of qualities also in me. So I think male role models, although African-American role models are very important, male role models, period, are essential to African-American men growing up. My question is, how has the penal system affected African-American men becoming teachers. We all know that there's a disproportionate number of African-American men who've been incarcerated for minor offenses. Once you have that jacket, once you have that background, it makes it virtually impossible to gather a teaching degree. So I would love for your guest to comment on incarceration and how it affects African-American teachers. I will take my comment off the air.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for calling. Professor.
Well, look, the criminal justice system and the schooling system are inexplicably linked. They have such deep connections that most people in the public do not see. And what Richard described is a reality. But most importantly, and I think what we should focus on that's sort of most pressing is actually what we can do in schools to allow young folks to feel like they have worth and value that will inhibit them from being pushed into the criminal justice system or making decisions that may lead them into the criminal justice system. So we know that we live in a society where young men of color in particular are going to get higher sentences, are more likely to be arrested for engaging in the same practices and behaviors as their counterparts from other racial and ethnic backgrounds. So if you know that's the case, then we have to make sure that we focus on a teaching and learning system that, one, makes them aware of that fact, that, two, makes them feel actualized so that they make more circumspect decisions because they know that society is already pushing them outside of things. But then most importantly, that we do not acclimate them to the norms of the criminal justice system in schools. What I mean by that is this. If we have a teaching and learning process that teaches young people how to shut up and pay attention, that teaches them only how to stand on the wall with your shoulders to the wall, which I've seen, that has bars on their windows, that has metal detectors before they walk into the building every day, you are actually creating a psychological training for spaces like the prison. And so, you know, when we talk about how do you do schools differently, we're talking about ensuring that schools become emancipatory spaces where young people feel like they can be actualized, and we don't send them subliminal messages about their self-worth and how criminal they are just by virtue of the structure of the school building. So, this gives us a point to jump off from that I don't even think we have enough time for. But, yes, the criminal justice system and the K-12 education system are linked. Yes, we can transform how many teachers we get if we don't send everybody to prison. And yes, we can change the imaginations of young people if we make schools look differently for them and make them feel as though they have self-worth.
Let's go next to Billy in Madison. Hello, Billy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have a couple of friends who are African-American males, former teachers from the Madison School District. And while they were employed, they both had expressed to me frustration that they felt that the schools would dump the more difficult and challenging black males in their classroom,
mm-hmm.
even when they protested. And so like they, and it was like, you know, that what your guest alluded to, that they had some sort of magic connection or understanding just because they were black. And when it was actually sort of like a societal issue, not just a black thing. And I'll take your guest's response off the air.
Thank you. Christopher.
Yeah, you know, and what we have to understand that this demonization of black youth also equates to demonization of black men. You know, the black men teachers that we want to keep in schools are the young kids we had in schools who grow up. And if we believe them to only be enforcers, angry managers of behavior, then they get unduly the responsibility of controlling behavior. And that doesn't work for them. And that's part of why they leave. And nobody wants to talk about it. And so the responsibility to keep a black male teacher in the school is not just on the black male teacher. It's on the school to ensure that that teacher feels comfortable in that space. That teacher needs to feel as though you see me as a equal and as a peer and as an academic and as an intellectual. So we don't see black males generally as intellectuals. We don't see them generally as being able to sort of like be able to talk about content matter in a way where it's complex and rigid. And so why those black male teachers are getting students dumped on them is because the school doesn't perceive them as being real teachers. You see them as being less than the other teachers, and that's what's being reflected.
And do they have access to complaints about that? Has there been a movement? I know there aren't very many African-American male teachers, but if that's happening to you, do you have recourse?
Well, frankly, right now that does not exist. And that is why I wrote that piece in the New York Times, and this is why I'm advocating for this work so passionately, because I feel like there's sort of this hidden code, this hidden language, which is like, you know, don't complain. You know, when you're a teacher, you shouldn't be doing this because you want to have a lighter load. You should be doing this because you care about young people. But yeah, I can care about young people, but need the tools to be effective. And my goal, my mission is to be able to do things to help these teachers to do better and to be able to have a life where they can be role models rather than a life where they are managers of behavior.
Let's talk about training just a little bit more. Professor, you wrote in the New York Times article that we should be training all teachers, black and white, to acknowledge the biases that they hold about their students based on their race, class, gender, sexual orientation, and physical ability. How do we train teachers in that regard? And do you think that there are a lot of people who come to the profession with a certain number of biases?
So the first thing I'm going to say is this, and I'm going to quote from Avenue Q. And people don't like when I say this, but the reality is that everybody is a little bit racist. Everybody holds biases. Everybody has misperceptions about folks who don't come from the same places that they do. And the issue in the world of education is that to be an educator, you almost like have to be sort of de facto colorblind. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't want an educator who's colorblind, because if you're colorblind, it means you don't see me. And it equates to invisibility. So we want teachers not to be colorblind, but to be deeply and keenly aware of race and their biases. So in our program, what we do is we begin our teacher preparation with having teachers write autobiographies about their life experience. When was the first time that you interacted with a person of color? When was the first time that you interacted with a person who was gay? When was the first time that you interacted with an immigrant? And what did your parents say about those immigrants? See, these are hidden things that shape human beings. You know, our life experiences shape us, but society tells us not to have conversations about things. And so we walk up into a classroom holding all these things. So the first way forward is for us to sort of unleash the things within us and then be able to sort of deconstruct them and then reconstruct our identities. And the reconstruction of the identity might make you be a more effective educator, or it might make you say, you know what, I don't need to be teaching. And either way, the young people are better off for it.
You have wrote in the article about untrained and unprepared black male teachers can cause more harm than good. Are you suggesting in some way that there are, because some are believing that having a role model in the classroom is very important, that we're recruiting African-American males and they're not going through a teacher training program? Or what did you mean by that?
What I'm arguing for is this, and what I mean is this. You have black educators in schools across the country with that tough love mentality going into schools doing damage to young people. And the school does not question it because they're just happy they got a black person in the school.
I see.
You have black folks who go into the school and they don't know themselves. And so they are victims of poor schooling because their teachers that they had were mean to them. And the teachers that they had made them feel like they were worthless. And the teachers that they had didn't give them second chances. And so now they grow up as adults. They've not troubled their past experiences, and they go into schools and by virtue of just being black alone, start recreating or rehashing their own past experiences with a perception that the damage that was done on them is necessary to do to the next generation. And at some point, even that cycle has to be broken. It would not be fair for me to be able to critique white educators in urban spaces who do violence on young people without highlighting the fact that there are some black educators who need to be retrained as well. That there are some black folks who are hurt who are teaching that need to get killed. Listen, broken people break people. And many African Americans that go through formal education have been broken by the school system. So in order for you to be able to go in there and teach effectively, you got to heal from that brokenness. If you have not healed from that brokenness, I don't want you in there with my young people because you're going to break them as well and continue the cycle of dysfunction.
In terms of some of the larger issues here, too, sometimes all this seems just overwhelming, all the things that need to happen so that young people are able to learn. Professor Emden, when you talk about the needs to make sure that each community has the resources, the same kind of resources, we're living in a society where there's great, great disparity between school districts in this country, and poorer school districts not having nearly the kind of resources nor the amenities that richer school districts have. Do we need to be addressing all of those kinds of issues with much more gusto than we are? And how do we address those, if we should be?
I think we certainly do. I think we need policymakers to be more honest and to do good work. I think we need school administrators to be more honest and to do good work. But I always believe that even in the midst of the absence of resources and inequities, we can always have a pedagogical equity, meaning that you can have a school with zero resources, with a bunch of educators who care and have the right strategies, and you can have a school that will overperform a school that has millions of dollars. Now, I want the millions of dollars if those students deserve it, because it's unfair that they don't have it. But if we focus on the process of teaching and learning, if we focus on creating magic in the classroom, if we focus on having educators prepared to do right by young people, we can overcome all the other inequities that we have. And that's been the history of African-Americans in this country in the educational system. So we have resegregated schools today. That's true. But we had segregated schools in the 50s and the early 60s, and those schools were successful. Students were performing. So the reason it's not about the resources. The resources help, but the answer is in the nature of the teaching and the learning. That has always been the answer, and it will always will be.
It's a very tough job, isn't it, teaching?
Oh, yeah, it's a tough job, but it's also the most beautiful job anyone can have. What other job can you have when you can walk into a classroom and change the lives of young people? You know, what other job can you have where you can open up a door to new possibilities? Or what other job can you have where you make young people feel as though they are worth $1 million even though their parents only have $10 in their pocket? You know, I do this work in the higher education space, but every single time that I need re-inspiration and reinvigoration, all I have to do is go into that classroom that I teach in on Fridays in the Bronx, and my fire is lit. And so while it's a tough job, if you describe it as time you put in and the work you have to put in, but there's no job on the face of this planet that's more rewarding than being an educator.
Yeah, I think you're right. What do you do in the Bronx? What do you teach?
I teach science. I run a program called Science Genius that, you know, I don't just talk this work, I do it. You know, we have young people writing raps about science content and learning science and seeing themselves as scientists. I am an educator, but I'm actually trained as a scientist. I'm an anthrobiochemist by training.
Oh.
I know that science and STEM in particular is where most young people are sort of pushed out. And so my work revolves around science, technology, engineering, and mathematics in particular to get, you know, young black and brown folks to be great in those disciplines as well.
Mm-hmm. And also on the way to areas where they're going to be able to get jobs when they're finished with school, right?
Absolutely right. And to peel the lies back about this larger STEM movement where folks are saying they're doing STEM and they're focused on STEM, but they have ineffective pedagogy, which simply is just alienating young people from these disciplines, which are the disciplines that they need to be successful in the future.
We're welcoming phone calls, and we have some lines open if you'd like to join our conversation. Professor Christopher Emden is our guest, associate professor at Teachers College, Columbia University. He's associate director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education. He also teaches science classes on Fridays in the Bronx, as you heard him say. And he's the author of For White Folk Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all Too. He wrote a piece that appeared in the New York Times that looked at this call for African-American males to enter the teaching profession, because only 2% do at this point enter the teaching profession. But he says, you know, what we really need are people who really want to be teachers. We don't need for the African-American male teachers to be the disciplinarians, as they frequently are given that kind of role, that we need them to be inspirational teachers and to love their students. So we're talking about the profession and how attractive it may be to African-American males, the importance of having a role model who looks like you do, and you can grow up to be like that person, or whether or not that is overrated in some ways, this role of tough love for a lot of African-American teachers. And here's how you reach our conversation. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, where we like to read your messages, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour, Professor Christopher Emden, associate professor at Teachers College, Columbia University, and our number is 800-486-8655. And we go next to Sharon in Minocqua. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. Kathleen. I'm calling because I was on the road this morning as well, and I heard a really great program. Joy Cardine was doing a show about the education as a profession right now,
mm-hmm.
and the lack of teachers. And this, I think this may also just have, just my observation is that this might have an effect on African-American males also joining the teaching profession, because it's just, that's just the way it is for everyone. But also, it seems to be when African-Americans, male and female, enter into professional careers, they're looking at also other careers like doctors and lawyers, engineers, and the teaching profession doesn't seem to be, you know, we've kind of, you know, put the teaching profession at such a low pay scale, and we don't even think of teachers as being professionals. So I think all of that has a lot to do with this lack of not just African-American males, but everyone entering into, you know, teaching as a profession.
Now, you bring up a good point. That certainly is happening in this state. Professor Emden.
No, that's absolutely true. And, you know, one of the things that I always try to do is to be able to have folks advocate and lobby to their politicians who have no idea about schooling and education, about how they deprofessionalize teaching. I mean, we know it's the anchor of our society. We know the whole sort of age-old saying about the fact that children are the ones who are going to guide us into our future. But yet, you have folks who are in positions of power who sort of demonize teachers and say they take summers off, et cetera. And those of us who are in the field, or those of us who are outside of the field, who know the value of teaching and teaching and learning, need to be able to sort of rally around educators. So she's completely correct. I wholeheartedly agree. I think that the teaching profession in general is just suffering from an absence of morale. And I think part of why that happens is because we teach teachers that all they do is to be sort of go in there and teach every day, be completely selfless, say nothing, and go do it every single day until the rest of your lives. And I think that if educators start understanding that, they need to be able to advocate for themselves. There are folks who are writing blogs and who are writing articles about education who haven't set foot in the classroom since they graduated from school. And if those people can have an influence on public perception in education, it's absolutely important that educators do the exact same thing. So I salute folks like Jose Bilson in New York City, who's a math teacher and teaches every day, but goes online and starts a movement of educators around this work. You know, I salute my teachers who join me on Hip Hop Ed every Tuesday at 9 p.m. Eastern, who are educators in classrooms every day, but they get on Twitter every Tuesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern and talk about their work and talk about their craft, and they blog and they write articles.
Oh, great.
We've got to reach the point in society where educators are no longer silent. You know, we are the ones who are driving the future forward, and we have to speak for ourselves.
Hip Hop Ed is called.
Hip Hop Ed. So it's hashtag HIP, HOPED. I tell the listeners, just go on now and just search hashtag Hip Hop Ed.
Okay.
And it's really progressive conversations about education. We do it on, I've not missed a Tuesday for the last 6 years. We throw out a topic, we just have conversations, and we have a party, and we empower each other, and we support each other so that we can keep doing this work.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Sharon, for your call. Camille in New Berlin. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call as well. Two comments. If a person is going to go into education, you need a four-year degree. That's a lot of bucks going to colleges. To get out to earn the salary that first-year teachers, even going on, get is not practical. Second of all, generally, what I've seen, I've taught for many years, is that the teachers who have good classroom control get more problem students. And, you know, you refer to the black males getting more problem students. It seemed like all the teachers who had good classroom control got the problem students. Very unfair system, but that's what exists right now in the world of education. I'll take your comments off the air. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Camille.
Yeah, she raises wonderful points. I think the lack of pay for teachers is not just unfair, but it's criminal. And I think that there are some fundamental shifts that have to happen in the nature of teaching. The idea that classroom control, quote-unquote, means that you're good is flawed. Students can control themselves if they're engaged in the content. If the students love you and love what you're teaching, and you say, okay, guys, I need you to be quiet now, so I'm going to give you an example, they'll be quiet. And so this the tough love notion exists in schools with African-American and Latino youth, and I'm telling you that it does not exist in schools of the students who are affluent. I visit schools across this country and across the world all the time, and the most affluent schools with populations that are not African-American, Latino, that are not socioeconomically disadvantaged, the nature of schooling is different. The kids are not asked to just be quiet and sit down and shut up. The kids are actually encouraged to ask questions. The kids are running around the classroom and the school building conducting their own science experiments. Their parents are actively engaged because they're welcome there and not demonized. And so in urban spaces, there's a perception that classroom management and sitting quietly means the teacher is effective. And in other spaces, for other young people, when your kids are engaged and asking questions, that means that you're effective. So something's got to give. The attachment of criminal behavior or criminal-type instruction or warden-type or correctional officer-type practices does not equate to effective pedagogy, and we've got to shift that.
And we go to Ruth in Madison. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just have a comment, and it's about teachers who get out of university and end up going into student teaching. And I think that so many times, or sometimes, those student teachers end up in cooperating teacher, lead teacher classrooms that do not have the pedagogy, the experience, et cetera, that you would like to see. And I think those new teachers pick up things that those cooperating teachers are doing, and it kind of supersedes their schooling and the that kind of thing. So I don't know how to take care of it, but I think that happens, and it certainly doesn't help.
I must say, your listeners are absolutely brilliant and absolutely insightful. And if I was going to have a conversation with people around education who had this kind of sort of sensibility around this work, the world would be a better place.
Oh.
And so again, I agree. It's a testament to you for pulling in this kind of audience. But yes, that's true. Teachers go in there and they learn from established teachers who are either burnt out or frustrated or don't want to be there to begin with. And it creates a cycle of dysfunction. And the way to break it, the only way I know how to break it, is to create these new networks of educators. And I really believe it's happening. There's a new cadre of folks who are on fire for this work and who believe in this work. I mean, that's why I write what I write, and that's why I preach what I preach and I say what I say, because we've just got to do things differently because the stakes are too high. And I think that we're reaching a point now where a new cadre of folks are understanding this is what needs to be done, and we're getting there. By the way, in addition to Hip-Hop Ed, hashtag Hip-Hop Ed, you'll meet folks on there who will encourage you and empower you and give you new practices. Folks who picked up my book, there's a hashtag on Twitter, hashtag for white folks. We just talk about the book and the ideas in it, and I respond, and we give each other feedback, and people say they agree or they disagree, and we just all get better for it. And I think that, we can look at this work and be pessimists and talk about how much gloom and doom exists and how we're not ever going anywhere. Or we can look at the other side of the equation, which is what I believe, or where I believe we are now, is that we're taking a turn, and folks are not being silent anymore, and they're looking at this work differently, and I'm excited about the future.
I would be, too, if I were in your classroom. Yeah, you're great. I'm just always interested how people get to where they are. And even though that African-American teacher you had, who was supposed to be perhaps a role model, who turned out not to be, somewhere along the line, Professor Emden, you were inspired. Somebody inspired you, because look at where you are now. And I'm wondering how that happened in your life.
I love telling this story. I've been inspired by so many people, by a cab driver that drove me when I went to grad school at RPI, when I thought I was just going to be a scientist and not get into education, who asked me what I did. And I said, well, I'm doing some mesenchymal stem cell research. And he says, well, say that to a regular person. And so I described my research to him. And he said, you know what? I get it. You should be a teacher. Folks, the inspiration comes from places that you wouldn't expect. So a really cool cab driver, a professor I had in undergrad named Liesl Jones, who told me I had a knack for both science and teaching. I've also been inspired by brilliant people that I knew who didn't make it in education. One of my best friends when I was in high school, who was absolutely brilliant, could memorize a rap album in 2 hours, knew the answers to everything, wrote the most amazing freestyle raps. And he didn't make it. And I always said, if I can make it through undergrad and I'm not half as smart as he is, then I can go back in schools and make somebody who has his type of intelligence turn on the schooling. So, this is going to sound really corny, and, you know, like I went to the Oprah school of self-belief, but I think inspiration comes from everywhere. And if human beings open themselves up to be inspired by people they meet or phenomena around them, they become inspired. And it's about opening yourself up to be inspired. And once you open yourself to be inspired, when you see inspiration in everyone around you, you know, your life shifts. And I think that that's sort of the anchor of my being, and that grounds me, is knowing that I'm not special, but lucky enough to be where I am. And the inspiration to keep continuing to do what I do is around me every single day. I've been inspired by your listeners. I've been inspired by you.
Oh, and we've been inspired by you, so everybody, you know, we're inspired. But the thing, how many professions do you have? And teaching has got to be way at the top, Professor Emden, where you have the possibility of inspiring so many people during the course of your teaching career. So many people, you're a source of inspiration.
Well, I deeply appreciate that, and, you know, I'm humbled when I hear that. And it drives me to keep going. And I have students that I've taught in seventh grade who are now teachers themselves. I have students I've taught in ninth grade who are doctoral students at Columbia.
Wonderful.
And each of us share the same sentiment, which is that we could transform education. I guess they're the ones who make me really sort of optimistic about what the future holds.
Mm-hmm. And then you have to think about what also happens, and that's the number of young African Americans who are kicked out of school, who are suspended from school. And
absolutely.
That's a huge problem in this country, too. What does that do for young people?
Well, you know, I know that experience oh so well. You know, I never went to my high school graduation. And I say that proudly. I didn't go to my high school graduation because I got into a fight and I got kicked out of school. I had to circle back and get in.
Really?
And for me, knowing that that is my personal experience, it allows me to recognize that young people who might have challenges in schools or who might get pushed out of schools doesn't mean that that's their end. And I think we have to have a culture of second chances in education. We have to have a culture where we allow folks to be able to rehabilitate themselves by giving them new opportunities. And, you know, part of why students get pushed out of schools is because of the lack of structure of schools. Students drop out of schools because of the inability of schools to capture their imagination. You know, students leave schools because teachers don't inspire them. And so when we understand that the responsibility is on us, that it's not a dropout, but rather a push out and kick out, and that we can change the narrative for young people if we change our practices, then we approach the question differently. You know, we put the responsibility on both ourselves and our students to be better. And I think that's a major piece of the work. It's just this consciousness shifting, it's perspective shifting.
Do you think teachers have too much put on them?
Oh, sometimes, yes. Absolutely. You know, you got to be a counselor, you got to be a teacher, you got to know your content, you got to be a psychologist,
right.
You got to be a sociologist. Absolutely, yes. You know, would the world be better if some of the challenges that some of the responsibilities we had on teachers could be alleviated so they can focus on the work of teaching? Yes, but it's going to take us convincing policymakers to be able to allow that. You know, I hear folks tell me all the time, well, teachers get summers off. I said, really? Well, in the summer is when they're planning for the fall. It's when they're buying new books. It's when they're getting lesson plans and orchestrating lesson plans. It's when they literally get a chance to breathe again after the work they put in over the course of the year. And as long as societies view teaching as a sort of easy job,
right.
Then we won't get them to be able to value the work the teachers put in. And so, yes, a lot is put on them. And, yes, we need to be able to alleviate those stresses. And if we do so, then that's another reason why we can get more folks to be recruiting to stay in teaching.
It definitely isn't an easy job. It's one of the best you can have, but it sure isn't an easy job.
You're right.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Christopher, for being with us and for this great hour. Appreciate it.
It was my absolute pleasure. If I may plug the book.
Oh, go ahead.
White Folks Teaching the Hood and the rest of y'all, too. It's on Amazon.com and Barnes & Noble. Join us on hashtag HipHopEd. And, you know, just stay in touch on Twitter. You can tweet me. My handle is @ChrisEmden, @ChrisEmden, and I share my Twitter so we can keep the conversation going.
Great. Thank you, Christopher. Christopher Emden, associate professor at Teachers College, Columbia University. He is the associate director of the Institute for Urban and Minority Education, as you heard him say, author of For White Folk Who Teach in the Hood and the Rest of Y'all, Too, and that Twitter thing sounds interesting, doesn't it? To have all these educators getting together and giving each other inspiration and ideas. I like that idea. So thanks very much to Chris Molina for producing this hour. And thanks to Scotty Myers for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking the first hour of our show tomorrow. Frontline has their premiere of the new season next week, and they're doing a two-hour special. 1 hour is on Hillary Clinton. 1 hour is on Donald Trump. We'll be speaking with the producer of next week's piece, who's gained valuable insights into both human beings. So that will be the first hour of our show tomorrow. And then the second hour of the program tomorrow, the author of Navigating Life, Things I Wish My Mother had Told Me. So that's coming up on tomorrow's program. Thank you very much for listening and for all of your calls. See, you were applauded again today. I love it when that happens. Yeah, that's a great audience. Yes, we do. Yes, we do. Thanks for listening. Until tomorrow.